To meet up and have breakfast the following morning. Sitting at the Bada Bean, we became fast friends and discovered we share a love for all things poetry and a willingness to throw our whole selves into our art. I think we sat there for about 3 hours. Since then, we've had a Sunday ritual of meeting up at 7 a.m. to workshop a poem and, more recently, manuscripts. Knowing Eleanor as your classmate or as your instructor, you may already be in awe of the width and breadth of her memory and recall. What you may not know as yet is her tireless passion for her art, her tremendous ability as an editor, her generosity, her dedication, her willingness to take risks, to be vulnerable, to stare into the past, and have her heart broken again and again and again until it yields the unexpected. Her wit and humor on the page are subtle, but upon rereading, those lines read new and continue to surprise. Eleanor Mary Boudreau is both a poet and a philosopher. Hers is a poetry of elegy, as well as a poetry of unflinching observation, which both meditates upon and celebrates the chaotic nature of life. Through her leaping reportage, we are sitting in the middle of a date gone wrong, living the play-by-play, and somehow watching from the audience. Through investigation, dialogue, and form, she triangulates meaning from the quotidian and the often overlooked. She persists for those moments that suggest we will get through this, and it will be all right. Eleanor's past lives include a year working in a dry cleaner on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, and more than 3 years working as a reporter for the NPR member station in Memphis. She holds degrees from Harvard, Columbia, the University of Houston, and is now thrilled to be here in Tallahassee working on her PhD. She has poems forthcoming in Tin House and Barrow Street, and has been published recently in Field, Copernickel, and New American Writing. Will you please give a warm welcome to my friend Eleanor Boudreau.
Hey everybody. Thanks for coming. End of the semester. And thank you, Tanya, for a lovely, lovely introduction. Your friendship, you were a very good friend to me at a time when I really did need a friend. And your help on my poems has likewise been invaluable. And thank you, Obi, for reading here tonight as well. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of your work after this. So when I was about 13 years old, I wanted to enter a costume contest on horseback, but I didn't know what I wanted to be. And my mom was like, "I know, Lady Godiva." And I didn't know who that was. I wasn't even laughing. And my mom was like, she rode naked through the streets of England to get her husband, the Earl of the Duke or whatever, to lower the taxes. And now I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, so there is a Puritan in South Boston. And this person was just mortified, you know, by the, when they heard the word naked, right? But my mom is a British lady, and so she grew up in the Church of England. And these are the people who persecuted the church so bad that they got up and came to America. So my mom is very much not a Puritan, okay? So she's just like, it'll be great. She gets me this skin-colored leotard. She gets me a long blonde wig. Lady Godiva has blonde hair. She used it to cover her breasts. Anyway, I put the stuff out on, and I go to mount my horse bareback before the costume contest. And I don't think I actually felt naked until that point. But usually when you horseback ride, you have a helmet, you have breeches, you have boots, I don't have any shoes on, and you have a staff, right? So I get on my horse without any of the usual protection, and I start walking around the costume class, and everybody on the sidelines on the railing is just laughing. They think this is hilarious. They're like, ha 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 ha, Lady Godiva. And then Like, I'm just more nervous because usually when you're riding, it's quiet. And my horse is explosive. She's athletic. And I don't know what she's going to do. She's going to take off, or she's going to rear, or she's going to buck. But she doesn't do any of those things. By some like miracle, grace of God, she's like, totally cool. We do the whole class. We line up to get the ribbons. And they gave me second place. And more than anything that has happened before or since, this has really prepared me for my life in poetry. that's what it's like. You get naked, I mean, not literally, but basically. You hazard your dignity and your limbs, and they laugh at you. And then they give you second place. So, thank you again, Tanya, for holding I'm going to do my best to follow that up. And all of that is just kind of a long way of saying these first four poems that I'm going to read are about the Puritans. So, this is Sonnet Boston Proper. In Providence, my boss said hesitation shows. Was true then, is true now. The radio we played. We want a lady in the street, a freak in bed, the spaces in between. I don't know how to feel. Three times I ran in a horse-drawn carriage like character and prejudice, as towers built by Puritan's offspring, tactless, cast phallic shadows over cobble streets, oblique junctions, chevrons of stone outdone, but not outclassed. The first you asked why I loved you. I did not know. I did not know what I should say. This is my fate. The horse hooves kissed the street. One horse, one of a pair, broke to canter. A three-beat, not a two-beat gait. And each beat registered on your face like a blow. The steel beams rigid, towers elastic, in air. So there are two recurring characters in my work. There's Eleanor and there's Ernest. And they're on-again, off-again lovers. And Eleanor isn't quite me, and Ernest isn't quite me, but you put them together, and that's basically who I am, what I'm like. Which is a damn shame, because these people were never, ever meant to be together. So you're going to meet both of these people in this poem. So as well as knowing that it's about the Puritan idea of predestination, the older I get, the more I think they were basically right about that. So that's one thing. But you're going to meet Eleanor, you're going to meet Ernest. They're taking a car trip. They're going to New Orleans. They're three likely to trip. I'll read them each. But what you need to know is Eleanor is married to somebody else. So this is called The Rhyme of the Naive Adulteress, and the first leg of the trip is called Predestination. The Puritans got a bad rep for being humorless, Ernest says on a car trip. But they had some good ideas. Life is like Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Like this trip, prescripted as to be or not, the question is bullshit. You can't be whatever you want or do whatever you want. You can't even say what you want, not without consequence. Eleanor looks out the window, the pain of which reminds in her dreams as a child. Transparent dragons were circling always, animating the landscape with their transparent scales, and she terrified. She always wanted to cry out, fire, 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 a moment too soon. The only time she could do anyone any good. Our heroine yelling fire, fire indeed. What naive and childish fuck when ultimately it comes down to simple game of luck. Tails, you're safe, but heads, you burn. So the second leg of the road trip is called the Mirror Up To. And what you need to know for this one is Eleanor is going to start out talking about something she did with her husband the week before, and her husband's name is Ron. Eleanor knows fate is fate, but she wants still to change the subject. With coworkers, we spend our Sunday at the chain nominating and electing each other. Rob won, "I like to watch movies where things blow up, a category I would have won if there was any justice in the world. I won best pickup for "Are You from Tennessee? Because you're the only 10 I see. You whore," Ernest says, as if on cue they laugh and laugh and laugh. Although it wasn't objectively that funny, her winning line outclassed the pickup, "I wish I was a mirror so I could see myself." The losing line was more poetic and often more true. "I do. I wish I was a mirror so I could see myself. I'm the poet. I can't help but insert myself into the poem." So the third leg and final leg that I'm going to read, the road trip is called Literal Interpretation. I'm going to read out some road signs. Roll with me. The signs along the road she feels enlarged and numerous. "For sale," one reads, for sale, pecans with a phone number. The signs are hard to comprehend. Antioch, missionary, Baptist, the prison she mistakes for a castle for the seventh time and cries, "You're acting crazy," Ernest says. He doesn't spell out why. Capital pun is always, always wrong. I agree. I think capital punishment is wrong, but whether or not God agrees is another question. Ernest says, "You have to tell me what you want." Like the Bible, she fears the words once said that cannot be and cannot be unsaid. You just have to. And like the Bible, she wonders if this is literally true. "I want to leave them," she says, "and I want to live with you." So, fun fact, this is the moment in the reading, the poetry, where the poetry stops being rhymed and metered, so we can hear the difference. It was Dorsey's idea to put Elmer and Ernest in the rhyme right the way they are now. The last thing you need to know about Elmer and Ernest is that they were together when they were both very, very young. And Elmer got pregnant, had an abortion, and at some point after that, they broke up. But ever since Eleanor has been writing postcards to Ernest, it's a little unclear. I'm actually not sure at this moment whether or not he's writing back, but she is writing postcards to him. So I'm going to read one of those now. So on the front, it's this picture of the painted ladies. This was Tanya's idea. She was like, put the painted ladies in there. They're those famous colorful houses on the hill in San Francisco. And if you've ever seen the sitcom Full House, they have shot at these in the opening credits to that. So that's the front of the postcard, and I'm just going to read what Eleanor has written on the back. "Dear Ernest, I wonder if our child would have been male or cursed. The rows and rows of houses, different colors, different layers like cake, and two tree trunks that end in vain and seeds like two fresh-cut hay bales, side by side and raised in air. Oh, to be an angel looking down, or God in infinite and sexless wisdom, and not have to look out or to look up. Sex, the sum of characteristics involved in reproduction that distinguish males and females. I know. I thought it would be different, too. If you wanted to know what sex was, Ernest, I could have told you. I could have saved us both." So if you're in feminist theory with me, I pulled that definition of sex from Merriam-Webster, the dictionary. It's not one of them necessarily feminine class. There used to be a lot of definitions in my work, like the definition of color blue, the definition of apology, the definition of friend. But the definition of sex is the one that's stuck around. So that tells you something. But I'm only going to read one more poem, and it's called "The Heart Is Not a Synonym for the Chest." It used to be a lineage poem, but I made it into a verse. Not that you really trust me, it looks a lot better on page. So, the heart is not a synonym for the chest. What you call a cloud is not a cloud. I am in hell here. Hell is a party where you don't sing and don't dance. And someone turns to me and says, "You are a very pretty girl. Don't ever forget that." I spend all night tramping up and down the staircase, trying to figure out if he really loved me. Each stair a copy of the first, and each of your words a copy of the one before it. Love, love, love. Above us, an 18-wheeler on the highway bucks and shifts, fishtailing, and you think of me. I would think of you too, bucking and shifting. But that is not my heart. That is my left breast. There is a photocopier at the top of the staircase. I make a photocopy of my heart for you. It says WTF. I am in hell and I have picked up some of the language. If I was Eurydice, I would not be mad at Orpheus. I'd be the register above. The truck, our house, our life together, these things I do not miss. A reminder written on every mirror, you are a very attractive lady. Don't ever forget, this I do not miss. The bathroom with its three mirrors, I am happy. Humming to myself in the morning, when you enter, you appear behind me again and lay your hand over my left hip like a shadow. This I do not miss. The bathroom, beginning to look like a lobster trap with its yellow bars of reflected light, and my skin turning pink with sex again. This I miss. The knowledge that there is blood and it is pounding, fishy rivers beneath the skin, squirming toward an inroad.